Chapter 19. Perhaps it was the stalemate that made Sonny Corleone embark on the bloody course of attrition that ended in his own death. Perhaps it was his dark, violent nature given full rein. In any case, that spring and summer he mounted senseless raids on enemy auxiliaries. Tattaglia family pimps were shot to death in Harlem. Dock goons were massacred. Union officials who owed allegiance to the five families were warned to stay neutral, and when the Corleone bookmakers and Shylocks were still barred from the docks, Sonny sent Clemenza and his regime to wreak havoc upon the longshore. This slaughter was senseless because it could not affect the outcome of the war. Sonny was a brilliant tactician and won his brilliant victories, but what was needed was the strategical genius of Don Corleone. The whole thing degenerated into such a deadly guerrilla war that both sides found themselves losing a great deal of revenue and lives to no purpose. The Corleone family was finally forced to close down some of its most profitable bookmaking stations, including the book given to son-in-law Carlo Rizzi for his living. Carlo took to drink and running with chorus girls and giving his wife Connie a hard time. Since his beating at the hands of Sonny, he had not dared to hit his wife again, but he had not slept with her. Connie had thrown herself at his feet, and he had spurned her, as he thought, like a Roman, with exquisite patrician pleasure. He had sneered at her, "Go call your brother and tell him I won't screw you. Maybe you'll beat me up until I get a hard-on." But he was in deadly fear of Sonny, though they treated each other with cold politeness. Carlo had the sense to realize that Sonny would kill him, that Sonny was a man who could, with the naturalness of an animal, kill another man, while he himself would have to call up all his courage, all his will to commit murder. It never occurred to Carlo that because of this, he was a better man than Sonny Corleone, if such terms could be used. He envied Sonny his awesome savagery, a savagery which was now becoming a legend. Tom Hagen, as the consigliere, disapproved of Sonny's tactics and yet decided not to protest to the Don simply because the tactics, to some extent, worked. The five families seemed to be cowed, finally, as the attrition went on, and their counterblows weakened and finally ceased altogether. Hagen at first distrusted this seeming pacification of the enemy, but Sonny was jubilant. "I'll pour it on," he told Hagen, "and then those bastards will come begging for a deal." Sonny was worried about other things. His wife was giving him a hard time because the rumors had gotten to her that Lucy Mancini had bewitched her husband. And though she joked publicly about her Sonny's equipment and technique, he had stayed away from her too long, and she missed him in her bed, and she was making life miserable for him with her nagging. In addition to this, Sonny was under the enormous strain of being a marked man. He had to be extraordinarily careful in all his movements, and he knew that his visits to Lucy Mancini had been charted by the enemy. But here he took elaborate precautions, since this was the traditional vulnerable spot. He was safe there. Though Lucy had not the slightest suspicion, she was watched 24 hours a day by men of the Santino regime, and when an apartment became vacant on her floor, it was immediately rented by one of the most reliable men of that regime. The Don was recovering and would soon be able to resume command. At that time, the tide of battle must swing to the Corleone family. This Sonny was sure of. Meanwhile, he would guard his family's empire, earn the respect of his father, and since the position was not hereditary to an absolute degree, cement his claim as heir to the Corleone empire. But the enemy was making its plans. They too had analyzed the situation and had come to the conclusion that the only way to stave off complete defeat was to kill Sonny Corleone. They understood the situation better now and felt it was possible to negotiate with the Don, known for his logical reasonableness. They had come to hate Sonny for his bloodthirstiness, which they considered barbaric. Also, not good business sense. Nobody wanted the old days back again, with all its turmoil and trouble. One evening, Connie Corleone received an anonymous phone call, a girl's voice asking for Carlo. "Who is this?" Connie asked. The girl on the other end giggled and said, "I'm a friend of Carlo's. I just wanted to tell him I can't see him tonight. I have to go out of town." "You lousy bitch," Connie Corleone said. She screamed it again into the phone. "You lousy tramp bitch!" There was a click on the other end. Carlo had gone to the track for that afternoon, and when he came home in the late evening, he was sore at losing and half drunk from the bottle he always carried. As soon as he stepped into the door, Connie started screaming curses at him. He ignored her and went in to take a shower. When he came out, he dried his naked body in front of her and started dolling up to go out. Connie stood with hands on hips, her face pointy and white with rage. "You're not going anyplace," she said. "Your girlfriend called and said she can't make it tonight. You lousy bastard! You have the nerve to give your whores my phone number? I'll kill you, you bastard!" She rushed at him, kicking and scratching. He held her off with one muscular forearm. "You're crazy," he said coldly. But she could see he was worried, as if he knew the crazy girl he was screwing would actually pull such a stunt. "She was kidding around, some nut," Carlo said. Connie ducked around his arm and clawed at his face. She got a little bit of his cheek under her fingernails. With surprising patience, he pushed her away. She noticed he was careful because of her pregnancy, and that gave her the courage to feed her rage. She was also excited. Pretty soon, she wouldn't be able to do anything. The doctor had said no sex for the last 2 months, and she wanted it before the last 2 months started. Yet her wish to inflict a physical injury on Carlo was very real, too. She followed him into the bedroom. She could see he was scared, and that filled her with contemptuous delight. "You're staying home," she said. "You're not going out." "Okay, okay," he said. He was still undressed, only wearing his shorts. He liked to go around the house like that. He was proud of his V-shaped body, the golden skin. Connie looked at him hungrily. He tried to laugh. "You gonna give me something to eat at least?" That mollified her, his calling on her duties, one of them at least. She was a good cook. She had learned that from her mother. She sautéed veal and peppers, preparing a mixed salad while the pan simmered. Meanwhile, Carlo stretched out on his bed to read the next day's racing form. He had a water glass full of whiskey beside him, which he kept sipping at. Connie came into the bedroom. She stood in the doorway as if she could not come close to the bed without being invited. "The food is on the table," she said. "I'm not hungry yet," he said, still reading the racing form. "It's on the table," Connie said stubbornly. "Stick it up your ass," Carlo said. He drank off the rest of the whiskey in the water glass, tilted the bottle to fill it again. He paid no more attention to her. Connie went into the kitchen, picked up the plates filled with food, and smashed them against the sink. The loud crashes brought Carlo in from the bedroom. He looked at the greasy veal and peppers splattered all over the kitchen walls, and his finicky neatness was outraged. "You filthy guinea spoiled brat," he said venomously. "Clean that up right now or I'll kick the shit out of you." "Like hell I will," Connie said. She held her hands like claws, ready to scratch his bare chest to ribbons. Carlo went back into the bedroom, and when he came out, he was holding his belt doubled in his hand. "Clean it up," he said, and there was no mistaking the menace in his voice. She stood there, not moving, and he swung the belt against her heavily padded hips, the leather stinging but not really hurting. Connie retreated to the kitchen cabinets, and her hand went into one of the drawers to haul out the long bread knife. She held it ready. Carlo laughed. "Even the female Corleones are murderers," he said. He put the belt down on the kitchen table and advanced toward her. She tried a sudden lunge, but her pregnant heavy body made her slow, and he eluded the thrust she aimed at his groin in such deadly earnest. He disarmed her easily, and then he started to slap her face with a slow, medium-heavy stroke so as not to break the skin. He hit her again and again as she retreated around the kitchen table, trying to escape him, and he pursued her into the bedroom. She tried to bite his hand, and he grabbed her by the hair to lift her head up. He slapped her face until she began to weep like a little girl with pain and humiliation. Then he threw her contemptuously onto the bed. He drank from the bottle of whiskey still on the night table. He seemed very drunk now. His light blue eyes had a crazy glint in them, and finally, Connie was truly afraid. Carlo straddled his legs apart and drank from the bottle. He reached down and grabbed a chunk of her pregnant, heavy thigh in his hand. He squeezed very hard, hurting her and making her beg for mercy. "You're as fat as a pig," he said with disgust, and walked out of the bedroom. Thoroughly frightened and cowed, she lay in the bed, not daring to see what her husband was doing in the other room. Finally, she rose and went to the door to peer into the living room. Carlo had opened a fresh bottle of whiskey and was sprawled on the sofa. In a little while, he would drink himself into sodden sleep, and she could sneak into the kitchen and call her family in Long Beach. She would tell her mother to send someone out here to get her. She just hoped Sonny didn't answer the phone. She knew it would be best to talk to Tom Hagen or her mother. It was nearly 10 o'clock at night when the kitchen phone in Don Corleone's house rang. It was answered by one of the Don's bodyguards, who dutifully turned the phone over to Connie's mother. But Mrs. Corleone could hardly understand what her daughter was saying. The girl was hysterical, yet trying to whisper so that her husband in the next room would not hear her. Also, her face had become swollen because of the slaps, and her puffy lips thickened her speech. Mrs. Corleone made a sign to the bodyguard that he should call Sonny, who was in the living room with Tom Hagen. Sonny came into the kitchen and took the phone from his mother. "Yeah, Connie," he said. Connie was so frightened, both of her husband and of what her brother would do, that her speech became worse. She babbled, "Sonny, just send a car to bring me home. I'll tell you then. It's nothing, Sonny. Don't you come. Send Tom, please, Sonny. It's nothing. I just want to come home." By this time, Hagen had come into the room. The Don was already under a sedated sleep in the bedroom above, and Hagen wanted to keep an eye on Sonny in all crises. The two interior bodyguards were also in the kitchen. Everybody was watching Sonny as he listened on the phone. There was no question that the violence in Sonny Corleone's nature rose from some deep, mysterious physical well. As they watched, they could actually see the blood rushing to his heavily corded neck, could see the eyes film with hatred, the separate features of his face tightening, growing pinched. Then his face took on the grayish hue of a sick man fighting off some sort of death, except that the adrenaline pumping through his body made his hands tremble. But his voice was controlled, pitched low as he told his sister, "You wait there. You just wait there." He hung up the phone. He stood there for a moment, quite stunned with his own rage. Then he said, "The fucking son of a bitch. The fucking son of a bitch." He ran out of the house. Hagen knew the look on Sonny's face. All reasoning power had left him. At this moment, Sonny was capable of anything. Hagen also knew that the ride into the city would cool Sonny off, make him more rational. But that rationality might make him even more dangerous, though the rationality would enable him to protect himself against the consequences of his rage. Hagen heard the car motor roaring into life, and he said to the two bodyguards, "Go after him." Then he went to the phone and made some calls. He arranged for some men of Sonny's regime living in the city to go up to Carlo Rizzi's apartment and get Carlo out of there. Other men would stay with Connie until Sonny arrived. He was taking a chance, thwarting Sonny, but he knew the Don would back him up. He was afraid that Sonny might kill Carlo in front of witnesses. He did not expect trouble from the enemy. The five families had been quiet too long, and obviously were looking for peace of some kind. By the time Sonny roared out of the mall in his Buick, he had already regained, partly, his senses. He noted the two bodyguards getting into a car to follow him and approved. He expected no danger. The five families had quit counterattacking, were not really fighting anymore. He had grabbed his jacket in the foyer, and there was a gun in a secret dashboard compartment of the car, the car registered in the name of a member of his regime, so that he personally could not get into any legal trouble. But he did not anticipate needing any weapon. He did not even know what he was going to do with Carlo Rizzi. Now that he had a chance to think, Sonny knew he could not kill the father of an unborn child, and that father his sister's husband, not over a domestic spat, except that it was not just a domestic spat. Carlo was a bad guy, and Sonny felt responsible that his sister had met the bastard through him. The paradox in Sonny's violent nature was that he could not hit a woman and had never done so, that he could not harm a child or anything helpless. When Carlo had refused to fight back against him that day, it had kept Sonny from killing him. Complete submission disarmed his violence. As a boy, he had been truly tender-hearted. That he had become a murderer as a man was simply his destiny. But he would settle this thing once and for all, Sonny thought, as he headed the Buick toward the causeway that would take him over the water from Long Beach to the parkways on the other side of Jones Beach. He always used this route when he went to New York. There was less traffic. He decided he would send Connie home with the bodyguards, and then he would have a session with his brother-in-law. What would happen after that, he didn't know. If the bastard had really hurt Connie, he'd make a cripple out of the bastard. But the wind coming over the causeway, the salty freshness of the air, cooled his anger. He put the window down all the way. He had taken the Jones Beach Causeway, as always, because it was usually deserted this time of night, at this time of year, and he could speed recklessly until he hit the parkways on the other side. And even there, traffic would be light. The release of driving very fast would help dissipate what he knew was a dangerous tension. He had already left his bodyguard's car far behind. The causeway was badly lit. There was not a single car. Far ahead, he saw the white cone of the manned toll booth. There were other toll booths beside it, but they were staffed only during the day for heavier traffic. Sonny started braking the Buick and at the same time searched his pockets for change. He had none. He reached for his wallet, flipped it open with one hand, and fingered out a bill. He came within the arcade of light, and he saw to his mild surprise a car in the toll booth slot blocking it, the driver obviously asking some sort of directions from the toll taker. Sonny honked his horn, and the other car obediently rolled through to let his car slide into the slot. Sonny handed the toll taker the dollar bill and waited for his change. He was in a hurry now to close the window. The Atlantic Ocean air had chilled the whole car. But the toll taker was fumbling with his change. The dumb son of a bitch actually dropped it. Head and body disappeared as the toll man stooped down in his booth to pick up the money.